Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the October 16th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows President Trump. In fact, almost the whole drawing is taken up by his face. The background is a light greenish yellow color, and he's talking loudly. I can't tell if he's mad, but his mouth is wide open. He's exclaiming something. And then in the cavity of his mouth, you see all these little COVID balls floating around. The title this week is Super Spreader: How Trump Triggered a Major COVID Outbreak at the White House. No surprise that that is our first main story, and we'll start right there. COVID comes to the White House. What happened? President Trump returned to the White House from 3 days of intensive treatment for COVID-19 at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center this week with a message that Americans shouldn't fear the coronavirus or let it dominate your lives. Trump set the nation on high alert when he announced last Friday that he and his wife, Melania, had tested positive for the coronavirus amid a major outbreak involving at least two dozen of the president's circle of aides and associates. Among those who got COVID were campaign chair Bill Stepien, spokeswoman Kayleigh McEnany, aide Hope Hicks, advisor Stephen Miller, GOP chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, debate prepper Chris Christie, and former spokeswoman Kellyanne Conway. Most had attended a possible super spreader event at the White House on September 26 to announce the Supreme Court nomination of Amy Coney Barrett, during which some 150 Republican officials massed in the Rose Garden in close quarters without masks. When his blood oxygen level dropped and his fever spiked late Friday, Trump was taken by helicopter to Walter Reed, where he was given an experimental monoclonal antibody treatment and dexamethasone, a steroid typically reserved for severe COVID cases. His physician, Sean Conley, later painted an upbeat picture of Trump's condition, but he declined to reveal the results of a lung scan, and Trump could be seen gasping for breath when he returned to the White House on Monday, even as he staged a balcony photo op where he theatrically whipped off his mask and flashed two thumbs up. The virus emptied out the Capitol after three Republican senators, Mike Lee of Utah, Tom Tillis of North Carolina, and Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, were also infected. Most of the Joint Chiefs of Staff went into quarantine after Coast Guard Admiral Charles Ray tested positive. In the West Wing, where masks and distancing have been discouraged, staffers were on edge as cases grew among Trump's handlers, press aides, and household workers. "People are losing their minds," said a Republican advisor. What the editorial said: Trump's dismissal of a disease that's killed 210,000 Americans and sickened millions is unconscionable, said the Washington Post. We'd hoped that after he scoffed at masks and safety measures, got infected, and landed in the hospital, a humbled Trump might better respect a fearsome killer and understand the fear and anger across the country at his botched handling of the pandemic. Instead, he's gone straight back to happy talk that has characterized his disastrous response, which led to the U.S. having the most deaths in the world. The White House owes the public a full accounting of Trump's condition, said the Washington Examiner. Instead, it has created more questions than it's given answers, offering conflicting stories about when he was tested and evasive accounts of his condition. The media has filled the vacuum with irresponsible speculation and sensationalism. The result has been confusion and chaos. What the columnist said. There's no denying that the President of the United States is a super spreader, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. The virus rampage through the White House has shined a bright spotlight on the president's recklessness. The outbreak is his presidency in miniature. The denialism, the disdain for masks and social distancing, the packed rallies, the perverse sense of invincibility, Trump's dismissive attitude toward the virus became an accomplice. Spare us the media hysteria, said Heather MacDonald in cityjournal.com. Trump's exhortation to get on with our lives is exactly right. The country is in the grips of a feminized ethos of safetyism, in which sacrifice and risk-taking become unthinkable, and courage and stoicism are pathologized. In the vain attempt to hide from the pandemic, we've locked down businesses, wiped out decades of hard-won prosperity, and turned vibrant cities into moribund ghost towns. Trump is modeling masculine leadership at its best, upbeat, rational, and unbowed. What did the president know, and when did he know it, asks Olivia Nuzzi and Ben Jacobs in nymag.com. Did Trump know he was infected, or bother to take a test, before facing Joe Biden in a debate hall last week? Why did he meet with donors at his Bedminster Golf Club after Hope Hicks fell ill, and on the same day he got sick? Did he get pneumonia? Weeks from the election, Americans lack reliable information about whether Trump is healthy enough to be reelected or fully capable of running the government. Trump's balcony moment was a fiasco for the ages, said Charlie Sykes in TheBulwark.com. Instead of newfound humility, we got the full cinematic rollout of the Orange Evita, with Trump looking like a man whose presidency was in the last stages of decadence. Trump stood unmasked in more ways than one, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. The president is now explicit about his plan for the pandemic. He has none, except to soldier through the deaths and pretend all is fine. With his words and acts, he is making it likely that more Americans will die. Our controversy of the week, Supreme Court. Should Democrats play constitutional hardball? It was only a matter of time, really, said Elaine Godfrey in TheAtlantic.com. Ever since Senate Republicans blocked President Obama's last nomination to the Supreme Court in 2016, progressive activists have been urging Democrats to add seats to the court and pack it full of liberal justices. With Mitch McConnell now rushing to ram through a confirmation of nominee Amy Coney Barrett before the election, giving conservatives a dominant 6-3 majority, even mainstream Democrats are clamoring to expand the court by 4 or even 6 members if the party wins control of the Senate and the White House. Why not, said Josh Blackman in Reason.com. The Republicans' justification for stealing 2 seats on the court is simply that they had the votes to do so. So why should an incoming Democratic majority show any restraint? First, Senate Democrats need to abolish the legislative filibuster requiring 60 votes for any bill to pass. Then Democrats can pass legislation adding several seats to the court. Bestowing statehood on Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico could be next. It would create 4 new Democratic-leaning Senate seats. Democrats have been squeamish about this kind of constitutional hardball. But since McConnell has been so ruthless, it's a game they should learn to play. It's hard to convey in words the monstrous enormity of what Democrats are proposing, said Charles Cook in NationalReview.com. These hypocrites have spent 4 years sounding alarms about Trump's shredding norms. But now that power is within reach, they can't wait to kill the Senate filibuster and destroy the Supreme Court, our system's two main bulwarks against tyrannical majority. No wonder Biden refuses to state his position on court packing, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. He can't demoralize his base by ruling it out, but he knows voters would punish them for their partisan power grab at the next election, enabling Republicans to add their own seats to the court and regain the advantage. Actually, adding justices might be the only way to restore an institutional legitimacy of the court, said Kinta Jurecic in TheAtlantic.com. If Barrett is confirmed, five of the court's nine justices will have been nominated by Republican presidents who lost the popular vote. And she'll be confirmed by GOP senators from states containing far fewer Americans, 153 million, than those of the Democratic minority, 168 million, said David Atkins in WashingtonMonthly.com. The white rural slant of the Senate, where Wyoming's 578,000 residents have the same two votes as 39.5 million Californians, erodes the credibility of the Senate and the judiciary. Only by adding states and scrapping the filibuster can we save our democracy from minority rule. We heard those same arguments before Democrats scrapped the filibuster for lower court judicial nominees in 2013, said former Democratic Senator Carl Levin and Richard Ehrenberg in the Washington Post. The result, thanks to McConnell's hardball, is a federal judiciary newly stacked with some 200 conservative judges. Scrapping the filibuster for all legislation would also surely backfire in the future, as it would remove the only incentive for negotiation and compromise. In this hyper-partisan era, compromise is dead, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com, and the filibuster, once rarely invoked, is a tool of obstruction. The result is that the Senate has lost the ability to routinely pass legislation, solve problems, and deliver the solutions Americans vote for. Isn't that supposed to be how democracy works? The filibuster must go. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for German words. After dictionary site Merriam-Webster.com reported a 30,500% surge in searches for the German-derived word Schadenfreude, the day that President Trump tested positive for coronavirus. Merriam-Webster defines Schadenfreude as enjoyment obtained from the trouble of others. It was a good week for New Age Publishing with the release of the U.S. Army's new Holistic Health and Fitness Training Manual. It recommends journaling, meditation, and short, infrequent naps to restore wakefulness, and notes that military service can help soldiers appreciate the interconnectedness of all things and people. It was a good week for trolling, after LGBTQ activists posted images on social media of gay men kissing with the hashtag Proud Boys. The Proud Boys leader said it was an attempt to turn the group's name into a slur. But it was a bad week for the NFL after 22 players and staff on the Tennessee Titans and three of the New England Patriots tested positive for the coronavirus. Their Sunday games were rescheduled to a later date. It was a bad week for bones after a Florida man sued McDonald's for $1.1 million after allegedly biting down on chicken bone in one of his supposedly boneless McNuggets. Alexi Stolfat claims he suffered unbearable jaw pain and required expensive dental work and is demanding a recall of all McNuggets. Finally, it was a bad week for unnecessary health risks. After a passenger on an Allegiant Air flight awaiting takeoff in Arizona refused to wear a face mask, he was punched, choked, and had his hair pulled by another passenger, dragged off the plane, and charged with disorderly conduct. Got a short news piece before we move on. Cruise ships to sail despite health risks. The Trump administration overruled the Centers for Disease Control this week to let cruise ships resume sailing on October 31st, in line with a voluntary plan the industry submitted earlier this year. CDC Director Robert Redfield has argued at a meeting of the Federal Coronavirus Task Force last week that the no-sail restriction, which expired on September 30th, should be extended until mid-February. The White House denied that the faster timetable was driven by a desire to cater to the politically powerful cruise ship industry ahead of the election. The CDC rebuked the industry in July for failing to institute basic health protocols to contain the virus. At the time, the agency had recorded 99 separate outbreaks aboard 123 cruise ships in U.S. waters alone. On our briefing page, we have the Biden agenda. Last week, we had President Trump's agenda for the next term. The Democratic challenger is pitching an ambitious, progressive platform. Joe Biden says he wants to be like Franklin Roosevelt, reviving the U.S. after an economic catastrophe while also fundamentally transforming it for decades to come. Even Senator Bernie Sanders says Biden's platform would make him the most progressive president since FDR. Since securing the Democratic nomination, the former vice president has moved to the left on key issues, forming a unity task force with Sanders and adopting Senator Elizabeth Warren's proposal of universal preschool and subsidized child care. His Build Back Better agenda includes more than $6 trillion in spending over a decade, which Biden insists he can negotiate with Republicans in Congress. We're not just going to tinker around the edges, he says. Last week, we looked at President Trump's agenda for a second term. Here is what Biden says he'll do if elected. COVID-19. Biden has hammered the Trump administration for failing to coordinate a unified national pandemic response. And one of his first appointments would be a single official charged with addressing persistent shortages in testing supplies and personal protective equipment. Biden wants the federal government to hire 100,000 people to conduct contact tracing, and his administration would encourage asymptomatic Americans to get tested if they've come in contact with someone who has tested positive. Biden conceded last month that as president, he would lack constitutional authority to impose a national mask mandate, but he would encourage mandates on the state and local level, plus new restrictions on lockdowns if necessary. Biden would push for hazard pay for essential workers, and he pledges that all Americans, insured or not, will not pay out-of-pocket expenses for an eventual COVID-19 vaccine. The economy. Biden proposes a level of public investment in American business not seen since World War II. He wants the federal government to spend $400 billion over 4 years purchasing U.S.-based goods and services and $300 billion in research and development for clean energy initiatives. Biden also calls for a $15 federal minimum wage and is aggressively pro-union. He wants the Treasury Department to offer interest-free loans to small and medium-sized businesses through the duration of the pandemic crisis. Moody's Analytics estimates that Biden's proposals would create 18.6 million new jobs in his first term and an average post-tax income bump of $4,800, while Trump's policies would lead to an estimated 11.2 million new jobs and a nominal income gain for the average household. Healthcare. Biden rejected Medicare for All during the primaries, promising instead to strengthen and expand the Affordable Care Act, now supported by a record 62% of Americans. He wants to add a public option for people to buy into Medicare, allow the federal government to negotiate pharmaceutical prices, and increase federal subsidies to drive down premiums for people who purchase plans on federal exchanges. With the new subsidies, a 40-year-old making $50,000 would save $168 per month on the second lowest cost gold plan, the Kaiser Family Foundation found. Biden's proposal would extend coverage to millions of low-income people in the dozen states that have refused to expand Medicaid. Biden also wants to lower the age of Medicare eligibility from 65 to 60 and invest $125 billion over 10 years in drug addiction treatment. Taxes. Biden proposes taxing corporations and the wealthy at much higher rates. His plans would raise about $3.8 trillion over the next decade, with 75% of that coming from the top 1% of households and more than half of that coming from the top 0.1%. Americans making more than $3.2 million a year. The top individual tax rate would return to 39.6%. Capital gains accrued by millionaires would be taxed as ordinary income, and the corporate tax rate would rise from 21% to 28%. He'd also apply the 12.4 Social Security payroll tax to earned income above $400,000. Education. In addition to universal pre-K for all 3- and 4-year-olds, Biden supports Sanders College for All Act, which would provide matching federal grants to states that eliminate public college and university tuition for students from households making less than $125,000. Biden also proposes significant investment in community colleges to improve campus facilities and eliminate tuition. He wants to ban for-profit charter schools and triple federal aid from $16 billion to about $48 billion to low-income school districts. Climate change. Biden has proposed $2 trillion in clean energy investments. He wants to upgrade 4 million buildings to meet energy efficiency standards, hitting net zero greenhouse gas emissions for all new buildings by 2030, install 500 million solar panels and 60,000 U.S.-made wind turbines to eliminate carbon emissions from the electric sector by 2035, and, most ambitiously, put the U.S. on a path to net zero CO2 emissions by 2050. When I think about climate change, Biden said, the word I think of is jobs. He'd also cancel Trump's withdrawal from the U.S. of the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement. We'll read a few of the best columns now. These first two come from the U.S., starting with the critical importance of masks. This fall and winter, the U.S. faces the possibility of a fierce second wave of the coronavirus, said infectious disease specialist Joshua Schiffer. But my research team has found that if most Americans wore face masks and had access to quick, inexpensive paper strip tests, cases of infection and deaths could be decreased substantially within weeks, allowing schools to open and distancing restrictions to ease. Face masks vary widely in effectiveness depending on their construction, but our studies show that if two people, one infected, one not, wore masks only 50% effective in reducing exhaled or inhaled virus, it would lower the risk of uninfected person getting COVID by 40 to 80%. And even when masking does not prevent infection altogether, it decreases by roughly tenfold the amount of virus to which people are exposed, making it more likely that they'll have a milder case. It's particularly critical that people wear masks in indoor, poorly ventilated settings to prevent the super spreader events that seem to be driving the pandemic. With a combination of masking, distancing, rapid testing, and emerging medical therapies, the worst of the pandemic might soon be behind us. Building homes that fuel wildfires. The heat and drought brought on by climate change is clearly contributing to California's wildfires, said Elizabeth Weil and Molly Simon. But so is years of building new housing in high fire risk zones. Strict zoning regulations in the state's affluent urban and suburban communities have driven 11 million Californians to move to remote areas, which planners called the wildland-urban interface. Living there requires people to drive more and emit more greenhouse gases. More importantly, it puts homes out in wooded areas that once burned naturally or had prescribed burns to prevent a backlog of dead tinder, but where officials now suppress fires to save houses. The new houses themselves are essentially big piles of fuel and accelerate rampaging wildfires. These homes also put human beings in the woods, and 95% of wildfires are caused by people. Firefighters risk their lives protecting these homes. Over the past 7 years, wildfires have killed 193 people and destroyed 50,000 structures. But the state isn't addressing the role California's housing and land use policies play in this ongoing catastrophe. We need to get a whole lot smarter about where and how we build. This is an international How They See Us column. An America no one wants to emulate. American presidential debates are not watched only by Americans, said Chinanand Rengatta in the Times of India. And with last week's ugly showdown between President Donald Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden, the United States embarrassed itself before the world. The president's frequent hectoring interruptions seemed more suited to a wrestling ring than a debate stage. Even Biden lost composure, calling Trump a racist and a clown and pleading, "Will you shut up, man?" Neither candidate won, but it was clear that America lost. The international observers could only cringe, said Henry Zeffman in the Times from the UK, watching what should have been a sober policy discussion degenerate into a squabble between two angry septuagenarians who palpably loathe each other. Trump's performance sandblasted away some cherished illusions about America, said Rosemary McLeod in the Press from New Zealand. Despite the country's many flaws, I've been appalled by its racism and its mass murders. I always thought the U.S. aspired to be better, to truly become a beacon of liberty, equality, and democracy. But after the debate, I could not confidently say what I thought America was anymore. What kind of nation could even consider re-electing a president who refuses to condemn white supremacists, one who told the racist Proud Boys militia to stand back and stand by? The idea of America as a role model died during the debate. I actually wept. For decades, America has imposed its model on the world, said Dmitry Kiselyov in Vesti.ru from Russia. Now it resembles a pastor, once neat and sober, who has begun showing up to church drunk, with his fly unbuttoned, leering and pinching his parishioners. One recoils in disgust, questioning all that came before, as did all of us who watched the debate. The America that lectured the world on civil discourse and norms is now revealing its hypocrisy. For example, U.S. journalists call me, Russia's top newscaster, a propagandist, which is a dirty word in English. But the last time I was interviewed on CNN, and I said in response to a question, "Russia is the only country in the world capable of turning America into radioactive ash in retaliation," CNN cut off the last two words. It turned my anti-war statement into an aggressive taunt. That is true propaganda. America is culturally degraded. While Trump's COVID-19 diagnosis may spare us any more presidential debates, what we saw left us deeply troubled, said Yomiuri Shimbun from Japan in an editorial. With his flurry of attacks on mail-in ballots and his refusal to say whether he would accept the result of the November 3rd election, Trump undermined the very basis of democracy. The U.S. is the premier global power, and all countries have a stake in its stability. If confusion over the vote count is prolonged and a power vacuum is created, it will affect the entire world. We are heading into a dangerous time. It's time for the last word, our in-depth article. Title this week, Divided Even Over Trump's Illness. Biden supporters see the president's case of COVID-19 as the result of epic irresponsibility, while Trump backers admire his resilience, said Jennifer Medina and Tripp Gabriel in the New York Times. Soon after he woke up on Friday morning, Cruz Zepeda, a 54-year-old Trump supporter in Phoenix, received a text from a lifelong friend eager to share a sentiment he found on Twitter. Looks like RBG successfully argued her first hearing with the Lord. Still in a bit of shock, Zepeda felt his anger rise. The friends once shared similar political beliefs, but disagreed more often than not over the last 15 years. This is not funny, he shot back. This is real time, real life, and really happening. The pandemic could have been a great unifier, a widespread and life-altering tragedy that inspired a notion of shared national purpose, as at other moments of crisis in the country's past. And perhaps in another moment, in another place, a president falling ill would have seen citizens keeping vigil regardless of political affiliation. But the coronavirus, which has sickened more than 7 million Americans, including the president, the first lady, and a growing number of people in his inner circle, has deepened divisions rather than united the country. Now, less than a month before Election Day, and with the president infected with COVID, interviews with voters in some of the most contested battleground states make clear that the divisions that the president himself has stoked in the country are being reflected back at him, with his supporters defiantly insisting he will hold rallies again before November 3rd, and Democrats, if not wishing him a turn for the worse, certainly not shedding any tears. A day before the president disclosed his illness, Zepeda, a crane operator who is currently out of work, stopped by a South Phoenix campaign office in a strip mall, wearing a blue Keep America Great mask to pick up another Trump-Pence lawn sign because, he said, several had already been stolen from his yard. In his eyes, Trump's revelation on Twitter that he had the virus was a powerful admission to be admired. He doesn't have to tell anybody, he said. In the same neighborhood, at a different strip mall, Sandy Kaintz, 73, saw a completely different version of events unfolding. As she walked into the Biden campaign office as a first-time volunteer, wearing a tie-dyed mask a friend had made for her, she lamented that the president hadn't taken the same precaution, regularly wearing a face covering. Asked if she thought his illness might unite the country, she quickly replied, "I hope not." Because he hasn't done anything to unite us at all, Kaintz added. Kaintz said she could not recall any other moment in her lifetime when she felt so deeply distrustful of the country's leader. She reached for a historical analogy, but could not find one that matched the kind of despair and division she now sees. I really can't think of a thing, she said. Acknowledging her age, which puts her, like the two presidential candidates, at higher risk from the coronavirus, Kaintz said she knew she probably shouldn't be out and about, in a campaign office, prepping to hand out yard signs. I just feel that I have to participate somehow, she said. There are few places in the country where the difference is in partisan perspectives is as obvious as it is in Phoenix, one of the nation's biggest cities within a battleground state that has had some of the highest infection rates in the country. The alternate realities can be seen in the basic approach to the campaign field offices. The Trump operation has held in-person events for weeks, with temperature screenings but no mask requirements. The Biden team opened two local offices last week, requiring supporters to wait 6 feet apart outside under stifling triple-digit heat before quickly picking up yard signs. Concern over the virus in Phoenix lined up as neatly along partisan lines. After Tuesday's debate before the president disclosed his illness, people coming to the Trump campaign office described the pandemic as a nuisance, exaggeration, or an outright hoax. Many said they thought masks should be optional, and anything else was a violation of their rights. A few people mentioned homemade herbal remedies and said they were skeptical of a vaccine. Few said they knew anyone who had fallen ill or died from the virus. At the Biden Field office in South Phoenix, a woman waiting to pick up signs began to cry as she described the ever-climbing death toll. Nobody she knew had contracted the virus, she said, but that, she said, was beside the point. Empathy should not be reserved for friends and family members. In other battleground states around the country, the voters, each campaign is working hardest to win over churned with a chaotic mix of thoughts and feelings on Friday, including concerns for the country if Trump's health worsens, private and not-so-private gloating, and resignation that what might have been a unifying national moment most likely will not be. Mostly responses were filtered through the partisan lenses that have divided Americans on seemingly every issue during the Trump years, both consequential and trivial. Supporters of the president were resolved to keep working on his behalf, with speculated that he would be back holding rallies soon enough. Many Biden supporters expressed varying degrees of satisfaction that Trump was experiencing a karmic shock after half a year of playing down the pandemic, which has claimed more than 205,000 Americans. In Philadelphia, Eric Johnson, a roofer who supports Biden, hoped the illness might lead to a change in the president's attitude. "It will open his eyes now," he said. Joyce Brodsky, a retired art teacher in Kewadin, Michigan, noting how Biden and his wife Jill extended sympathy to the Trumps, said she was unable to feel so selfless. "I'm more of a serves you right type of person," she said. While some Biden supporters spoke of the president's illness as payback for holding rallies, mocking Biden for wearing masks, generally refusing to wear a mask himself, Cliff Kanan in Philadelphia had only one comeuppance in mind: being able to vote Trump out on November 3rd. "I think it's very important that people have their say in rejecting what he stands for," said Kanan, 31, software manager for a bank. "I don't want him to resign or be out of office in any other way than the ballot box." Many Biden supporters expressed the hope that Trump and his ardent base would stop turning health experts' guidance into a cause for partisan warfare. But that seemed unlikely. Last week, even as the positive tests and the president, first lady, and others around them were announced, Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin joined a lawsuit to block a mask mandate issued by the Democratic governor. The virus is surging in the state, with 17,000 new cases in the past week. Trump supporters, for their part, were eager to wish him well and move forward. Mira Katerinos, 59, a registered nurse in Waukesha, Wisconsin, said she was a strong supporter of the president, and that, to her, he appeared strong physically and mentally. "Trump will probably do more campaigning with COVID than Biden did with no COVID. He hardly seems to be campaigning at all," she said, repeating a common Trump campaign criticism of his opponent's schedule. She said she saw no problem with Trump resuming rallies after recovering, which she expected him to do. "Life has to go on," she said. In Clinton Township, Michigan, Jared Maynard also thought life would continue as usual. He said he would continue to knock on doors, trying to convince voters in the key county of Macomb that the president deserves re-election. "For me, I'm already taking precautions, so I'll wear my mask and try to social distance," said Maynard, 40. "The president will put his health first, and the campaign will move on." Politically, few voters expected Trump's personal encounter with the coronavirus would shake his supporters' faith in him. Jeff Lischer of Stetsonville, Wisconsin, said he thought he was naive enough to think that some people might take down their Trump signs after the revelations. In Bob Woodward's latest book, that the president privately admitted to the risk of the virus while playing it down in public. But if anything, they have multiplied, said Lischer, the host of a radio show in Wisconsin's North Woods who plans to vote for Biden. Just as the Trump signs multiplied around the country, many people spoke of divisions multiplying too. Zapita, the Trump supporter in Phoenix, sees this up close. The pandemic has taken a toll on him. He has been laid off from his job, and he believes he might have had the virus when he was seriously ill in February. He is awaiting an antibody test. He does not blame Trump for any of his views and views him as relentlessly strong leader. He is aware, though, of how much harder the Trump era has made it to really talk to people. He proudly describes himself as a Mexican with a gay daughter with a black grandchild, but worries that despite the different worlds he has footholds in, 2020 is a tipping point that will prevent discussion of differing political views because the divides are so entrenched. When he thinks about people he disagrees with, liberal friends who object to his support for the president, he can't imagine having a real conversation. There's no listening. There's no nothing, he said. A version of this story originally appeared in the New York Times. Read one of the obituaries this week. The pop star who sang of female empowerment, Helen Reddy, 1941 to 2020. Helen Reddy gave the 1970s women's liberation movement its anthem. A number one single in 1972, I Am Woman, married a buoyant pop melody with a message of female empowerment. I am woman, hear me roar. In numbers too big to ignore, it began, building to a chorus of I am strong, I am invincible, I am woman. The track became a touchstone, sung at demonstrations, and it made the Australian singer into a pop culture force. She notched two more number one hits, Delta Dawn in 1973 and Angie Baby in 1974. Hosted a variety show on NBC and acted in movies, making her debut as a guitar-playing child comforting nun in the disaster flick Airport 1975. While Reddy wrote few of the songs she performed, the lyrics to I Am Woman were her own. There were a lot of songs on the radio about being weak and being dainty, she said. I certainly didn't see myself as being dainty. Reddy was born in Melbourne into a show business family, said the New York Times. Her parents were actors who performed on the Australian vaudeville circuit, and she began joining them on stage when she was four. She left school at 15 and by her early 20s had built a solid reputation as a TV and radio performer. In 1966, Reddy won the top prize in a talent contest, a trip to New York City, and a record company audition. When the audition went nowhere, she stayed and played low-paid gigs to support herself and her three-year-old daughter, said the Times. Down to her last $12, she met Jerry Wald, a talent agent who became her manager and her second husband. The pair moved to Los Angeles, where Wald landed Reddy a deal with Capitol Records after bombarding the label's head with phone calls for months. By the early 1980s, Reddy's hit streak had ended, said the Washington Post. In subsequent years, she recorded sporadically and increasingly turned to acting, often in musicals. She retired from show business in 2002, becoming a clinical hypnotherapist. She also published a memoir in which she discussed her interest in reincarnation and past lives. Elvis Presley, she wrote, had once been Tutankhamun and King Tut. In later years, Reddy noted that her signature song had never lost its relevance. It just shows that while so much has changed, she said in 1993, so much also hasn't. And we'll just flip over for a couple of the health and science articles, starting with hopes for nuclear fusion breakthrough. In a potential leap forward in the quest for abundant clean energy, scientists developing a small nuclear fusion reactor have shown that, on paper at least, their project is very likely to work. A fusion reactor would essentially mimic the process that powers the sun, smashing lightweight atoms into one another at temperatures of tens of millions of degrees to release energy. Like a conventional nuclear fission power plant that splits atoms, a fusion plant would not generate planet-warming greenhouse gases, but its fuel source, isotopes of hydrogen, would be more plentiful than the uranium used in current nuclear plants. Fusion would also generate lower levels of radioactivity and waste than fission. The new project, SPARC, S-P-A-R-C, is the brainchild of researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. They say construction on the tennis court-sized reactor will begin next spring, and that if testing is successful, it could be generating electricity within a decade. That timeline appears ambitious, reports the New York Times. The most advanced current effort, a multinational $22 billion project to build a soccer field-sized reactor in France, has been underway since 2013 and isn't expected to produce a fusion reaction until 2035. But in seven peer-reviewed papers, SPARC's developers laid out why their process would work, producing 10 times the energy it consumes. If we can overcome the engineering challenges, said Martin Greenwald, co-lead scientist, this machine will perform as we predict. Plastic-eating super enzyme. Scientists in the U.S. have developed a cocktail of enzymes that can break down plastic much more quickly than current methods, a possible game changer for recycling. Researchers have been seeking to harness the natural digestive qualities of enzymes since the discovery of plastic-eating bacteria at a Japanese landfill in 2016. The new super enzyme is a combination of peptase, an enzyme previously shown to break down plastic, and another enzyme called MHETase. When these are stitched together, the scientists found, the speed of the breakdown increased sixfold over when PETase is used alone. The process leaves behind the building blocks of plastic, which can be used over and over again. We were actually quite surprised it worked so well, said author John McGeehan from the University of Portsmouth. Because fossil fuels are required to make plastic, he says, we're looking at huge energy savings. The superenzyme is still a slow mover. Recycling a plastic bottle would probably take days or weeks. But McGeehan and his team are exploring ways to cut the degradation time by softening the plastic, for example, and to scale up their operations. And we're over on the talking points page now. We'll start with the election. What if a candidate dies? President Trump's illness with COVID-19 and Joe Biden's risk of infection have pushed to the forefront a knotty question, said election law expert Richard Hazen in theslate.com. What happens when a presidential candidate dies or becomes incapacitated this close to the election? Thanks to our Rube Goldberg machine for choosing the president, the answer is murky and may lead to chaos. If a candidate dies before the election, it's up to the party's National Political Committee to choose a replacement candidate. With millions of votes already cast, the election would have to proceed with the deceased or incapacitated candidate's name on the ballot. Then, because it's the Electoral College that actually elects the president, we face a complicated question. Whether state legislatures would allow electors to switch their votes to the replacement chosen by the party, presumably, though not necessarily, the vice presidential candidate. Things could get especially tricky if some legislatures go rogue and seek to appoint electors directly who support an alternative to the vice presidential candidate. There's another possible scenario, said election law expert Richard Pildes in the Washington Post. A candidate wins the election and then dies before the Electoral College meets on December 14th. The issue again becomes, how do the electors cast their votes? Some states legally bind electors to votes for the candidate who won the state vote and make no provision for a circumstance in which that person has died. Most likely, electors would simply ignore these laws and rally around whomever their political party has settled on as a replacement. But we'd be in uncharted waters, and our sharply divided nation, the politics might become extraordinarily intense. As messy as all of this could be, said law professor Brian Cault in TheAtlantic.com, there's an even messier possibility. What if a candidate becomes very sick before the election, but is unwilling to withdraw? Party leaders could attempt to oust him, but nobody would want to stage that fight in the middle of an election. Even a president who'd been removed by the 25th Amendment could insist on remaining on the ballot, and most likely the party would be stuck. The upshot is that while there are processes on the books for handling a candidate's illness or death, that doesn't mean they wouldn't be accompanied by serious political upheaval. If Trump takes a turn for the worse, hang on to your hats. Refugees no longer welcome in the U.S. President Trump just dealt another blow to the U.S.'s already decimated refugee program, said Nicole Naria in Vox.com. With just minutes to go before a midnight deadline, the administration capped the number who could enter the country over the coming fiscal year to 15,000, or less than at any time during the program's 40-year existence. The historical average is 95,000. Last year, the administration capped the number at 18,000, but admitted only 11,814. This despite crises in Syria and Venezuela, helping to drive more people from their homes, almost 80 million, than at any time since World War II. Historically, the refugee program has flourished under Republican presidents, but bipartisan support eroded after unfounded rumors swept the globe that a Syrian refugee had participated in the 2015 Paris terror attacks, and Trump has relentlessly cut the program each year since taking office. With good reason, said Mark Krikorian in NationalReview.com, refugee resettlement had become a racket, with State Department-sanctioned charities such as World Relief and Catholic Charities getting paid by the head to find refugees, bring them here, settle them in apartments, sign them up for welfare, and then move on to the next batch. Under Trump, only truly needy people are being admitted. He also issued an executive order currently blocked by a court, giving state and local governments more say-so in whether refugees are resettled in their communities. Trump thinks this will play well with the rural and small-town whites he needs to win re-election, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. Hours before reducing the cap, he unleashed a long and hateful diatribe in Minnesota, home to the nation's largest Somali refugee community, in which he accused Democratic nominee Joe Biden of planning to turn the state into a refugee camp. Whether such policies benefit Trump politically is an open question, said the Post in an editorial. But they have diminished this country is not. For decades, America accepted more refugees than the rest of the world combined. Now we can't even find room for the 4,000 Iraqi interpreters who risked their lives for this country and were online for entry last year. We let in 123. America was once a symbol of hope for the world, but Trump has sought to slam shut the nation's door to legal and illegal immigrants alike, and our national policies are now guided by hatred, division, xenophobia, and fear. We've got time for a couple of the short notes. More than 22 million Americans recently told the U.S. Census Bureau they hadn't had enough to eat at some point during the prior week. Michigan's Attorney General charged two right-wing activists last week with making thousands of robocalls to minority voters, warning them that personal information on mail-in ballots could be used to execute outstanding warrants, be sent to debt collectors, or force them to be vaccinated. Jack Berkman, 54, and Jake Wall, 22, were accused of making about 85,000 such calls nationwide. On the poll watch, 92% of Americans now report wearing a mask when they leave the house, with 74% saying they always do, up from 60% in July. And I'm going to finish with a quote that just really cracked me up from humorist Dave Barry. He says, "It is inhumane, in my opinion, to force people who have a genuine medical need for coffee to wait in line behind people who apparently view it as some kind of recreational activity." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.